I'll be talking about finding grades for not a billion particles. I'll be producing that promised C0 you can compare with the one that John just showed. This is part of an ongoing collaboration with Steve Simon and two graduate students. A lot of what I'll be talking about is in these two papers, but there are some new results, and for many of these new results, really, I want to emphasize the contribution of my student Layla Ramosi. She's really been most of these new results are work really her. Okay, so here's this idea that John just confessed he fell in love with, and probably we've all, everyone at least in this room, has fallen in love with it. The idea of using these non-abelian states to do topological quantum computing, this idea that Alexei Kislyak. So here's one of these states we've been hearing about, and here are a bunch of quasi-particles, and if these quasi-particles are well separated in a non-abelian state, we have some big, exponentially big Hilbert space in the number of particles. Exponentially large number of degenerate states. And as we can somehow drag these particles around each other and trace out a braid in three-dimensional space-time, then associated with that braid is some unitary operation, which could correspond to some computation we want to do. And the beautiful thing is, well, not only is this Hilbert space is topological, so to actually distinguish states in the Hilbert space, you have to perform some kind of global measurement. So the states are intrinsically protected from the environment. And furthermore, if we trace out this braid, it isn't traced out perfectly. All we care about is the topology. This matrix is unchanged. And so this physical robustness is a potential resource for doing a robust quantum computation. Again, this is this idea due to Kataya. Although the particular kind of topological quantum computation I'll be talking about is really the one that was first discussed by Friedman, Larson, and Wang. Again, but associated with these non-abelian particles, there's some theory which allows you to calculate, given the braid, calculate the matrix that corresponds to that braid. What I'm going to be talking about is doing the inverse problem. If you hand me a matrix, how do we turn it into a braid? Or more practically, if you hand me some quantum algorithm you want to carry out on one of these topological quantum computers, how do we actually find the braid that carries out the algorithm? And the particular kind of non-abelian particles I'll be talking about are these so-called SU2 level K non-abelian particles described by this SU2 level K Chern-Simons theory that we've been hearing about. This is of interest, partly because this SU2 level K theory describes the quasi-particle excitations of the Riemann-Zeie pair of fermion states at level K, up to details which don't matter for quantum computation. And that's exciting because there's reason to believe, at least one of these states, or two if you count the K plus two states, the Moore-Reed state, may actually exist in real experiments. And there's the prospect of realizing other values of K and spinning those of condensates. Of course, there are other systems where you might be able to realize these non-abelian particles, some of these string net models we heard Paul talking about this morning. These particles, they may actually exist now, and in the future, there may be many systems which have these non-abelian excitations. For the purposes of quantum computation, one of the things that Friedman, Larson, and Wang proved is that for these SU2 level K particles, for K equals 3 or K greater than 4, K equals 4 is sort of an odd man out here, these particles are universal for quantum computation. What that means is if you give me any matrix, there exists a braid that corresponds to that matrix. And not only that, this paper was a constructive proof. It actually gave you a recipe for finding that braid. And to a large extent, I'm just going to be talking about what happened when we tried to follow that recipe. Now I have a confession to make, which is I may be the only person in this room who 3 years ago didn't know what SU2 level K meant. I mean, maybe people would bring it up and I would nod, but I was faking it.
You're not the only person.
Yeah. Well, my point is I'm still faking it a little bit less than I was before. I first learned about them when Steve Simon showed me this paper by Slingman and Bias, which was surprisingly readable. And thank you, Ghost.
Next to the first author?
Well, And one of the things I found comforting as I read through this is, again, something that I think many of you know quite well, is that SU2 level K isn't that different than SU2. These particles aren't that different than ordinary particles with ordinary spin. I found that comforting because, I understand ordinary spin. And also from the point of view of building a quantum computer out of these things, certainly many people are trying to build quantum computers out of spin. It's almost a respectable profession. So it's sort of reassuring, then, this analogy is reassuring to the point, you know, why not build quantum computers out of this quantum deform spin? And I actually want to push that analogy a little bit more. So to do that, I just want to start with just ordinary SU2. So at Florida State University, we teach all of our students that particles have spin. And that spin can be a half integer, so 0, 1, half, 1, 3 half. So let's say this green particle is a spin 1 half particle. It could be an electron. And there's a simple rule for adding angular momentum. If I combine two particles with angular momentum with spin S1 and S2, then the allowed spins run from S1 minus S2, the absolute value of S1 minus S2, to S1 plus S2. A famous example that everyone knows is if we have two spin 1 half particles, they can either form a singlet or a triplet. And if, for some reason, I didn't care about the SZ quantum number, all I cared about is total spin quantum numbers, I could represent, or let's say just I insisted that the total SZ be 0, I could represent the state of two of these spin 1 half particles with this kind of funny notation, where I just draw a circle around them and label them with their total spin. So this is a pair of spin 1 half particles with spin 0, so singlet, and here's a triplet. And what this combination rule tells us is that we have two of these spin 1 half particles. We have a two-dimensional Hilbert space, again, ignoring the SZ quantum number. Of course, the triplet is threefold degenerate. We can, again, if we forget about the SZ quantum number, a useful way to think about the Hilbert space is just to imagine, let's imagine a line of these particles and just keep adding the spin 1 halves. So, for example, here's the first particle, it has spin 1 half. The second particle can have total, if I combine it with the second particle, it can have total spin 1 or spin 0, and so on and so on. This particle, this diagram just keeps going off to infinity. This is, I guess, the most trivial example of a Bertelli diagram. And this picture is useful because states in this Hilbert space, or a basis for this Hilbert space, corresponds to paths in this diagram. So this would be a state of, five particles with total spin 3 halves. So if I want to calculate the degeneracy of these states, again, ignoring the SZ degeneracy, all I have to do is count these paths. And if you do that and fill in this diagram, you get these nice numbers, for which they're simple expressions, but here they are. They grow asymptotically as 2 to the n, of course. But why would you do this? Certainly, people who are trying to build quantum computers out of spin usually just talk about using the upspin and the downspin as the qubit. Well, in fact, there is an approach to quantum computing which these kind of pictures actually are useful, and I think even appear, or things like this, you can find them in these papers. These are papers that deal with so-called exchange-based quantum computing. So again, I find this a useful analogy with topological quantum computing, so let me just tell you a little bit about this idea. Here the idea is, let's imagine you're computing with a bunch of spins, let's say an array of electrons and quantum dots, and your only resources you can turn on and off the exchange interaction. So exchange doesn't mean exchange like braiding, it just means when the electron wave functions overlap for some period of time. And you lift the degeneracy between the zero state and the one state, between the singlet and the triplet, and so you get some phase, depending on how long you turn on this interaction, you get some extra phase for the one state, rather than the zero state, and you apply this unitary operation somehow on this Hilbert space. If this is your only resource, could you do quantum computing? And this is a question people ask themselves, partly because it may be in certain quantum computer designs, the ability to turn on and off the exchange interaction may be one of the easier things to do. So is that enough to do quantum computation? And the answer is yes, though it requires this concept of encoded universality, or encoding your qubits, because of course this interaction is rotationally invariant. It can't change the total spin of the system, so it can't perform arbitrary unitary operations. But if you encode your qubits, and so this is, I think, one of several encodings that I think appeared in this paper, where using this funny guy, this funny notation I introduced, where these two particles are in the singlet and these two particles are in the singlet, and the total spin is zero, so all four particles are in the singlet. Then it's just there. If all four particles are in a singlet, it's just a two-dimensional Hilbert space, and here are the corresponding Bertelli diagrams. And so now, so here's this big full Hilbert space, and here are the encoded qubits. So this would be the computational Hilbert space of the computer. So there's a, you know, there's a huge, an infinite amount. I mean, it's really a criminal waste of Hilbert space up here that you're throwing away, but you're willing to do it to get these qubits, which allow you to think in sort of more conventional quantum computing language. And so now can I compute with these qubits? Well, I have to be able to perform single qubit operations on these qubits. I also have to be able to entangle them. I have to do two qubit gates. And there, you're going to run into, there's a potential for problem, because as you entangle these two qubits, you might leak into the Hilbert space corresponding to these paths, which are not in this red, you know, logical qubit space. So you want to avoid those. I'll call those leakage errors. So we want to avoid that. And this is a problem that has been studied for various encodings, including this four-spin encoding. Here's a solution. Where essentially just by turning on and off the exchange interaction here, I actually notice doesn't involve just nearest neighbor interactions, but there existed a similar constructions which just involve nearest neighbor interactions. You can do arbitrary single qubit gates, and also you can do controlled knot gates. Now, of course, these times you can look them up in this paper. I think they're computed numerically. And so of course, you know, you're not going to be able to hit these times exactly. There's going to be some error. So this is the sort of thing that, you know, with the help of this fault tolerant quantum computation, one could actually conceivably build a quantum computer, which I guess means each of the CNOTs in your movie would have all of these things going on. Okay. So I wanted to introduce that notion of quantum computation, the exchange-based quantum computation, because it's not that much of a journey from there to the topological quantum computation with SU2 over K particles. All you have to do is Q deform things, which is easy to do, and it can be done in a very relaxed way using the fade transition in PowerPoint. And we go from SU2 to SU2 level K. And now instead of particles have spin, they have topological charge. And at level K, and this K is some integer, 2, 3, 4, 5, so on, the topological charge S now can run from 0 all the way to K over 2. So, but not to infinity, so it's truncated. So I'm going to still have my green particles correspond to the topological charge 1/2 particles. And these now are going to correspond to perhaps quasi-particles in some redesigned state. And there's, again, the fusion rule, or the triangle rule is an example of a fusion rule. And the fusion rule for combining this topological charge has the same form, except it's truncated, again, because it has to be, because we're not allowed to have spins or topological charge larger than this k over 2. However, it's still true, as long as k is greater than or equal to 2, that if we combine two objects with topological charge 1/2, they'll either form a singlet, have topological charge 0, or a triplet, although there's just one state, topological charge 1. So again, I can draw this picture and use this notation where I draw ovals around particles and label them with their total topological charge. Now, if we go back to this diagram, this Bertelli diagram showing the degeneracies for ordinary spin, again, what this truncation does, one of the things it does is cuts off this diagram. So for k equals 4, we're not allowed to have topological charge greater than 2. And again, I can count paths in this diagram, and I get this set of numbers here, which I think for large n scales is 3 to the n over 2, if I follow this number for large n, for example, which tells you the quantum dimension is of these particles is square root of 3. Or for k equals 3, you get, of course, everyone loves it, it's the Fibonacci sequence, 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13, 20, 34, and so on. And this corresponds possibly to the 12/5 state in the fractional quantum Hall effect, if that is in fact k equals 3 Riemann-Zeiss state. And then for k equals 2, you see the familiar 2 to the n over 2 minus 1 of the thought, to the n over 2 minus 1 degenerates. Okay. So so this is the Hilbert space. It doesn't look that much different than the Hilbert space for exchange-based quantum computing. And how are we going to manipulate the states? Well, rather than turning on and off the exchange interaction, we're going to exchange particles. So again, a calm fade from one slide to another in PowerPoint makes it not very dramatic. And so again, if I interchange particles, depending on the total topological charge, I get some phase, and these phase factors depend on K, the way I've shown here. They have a nice property that is reassuring. If I take K to infinity, I get a minus sign here and a plus sign here, which just reflects the fact as we go to K goes to infinity, as K goes to infinity, these become like ordinary spin 1/2 particles, and that's the minus one we all know about when you interchange particles in the singlet, and the plus one when you interchange particles in the triplet. But once we, but now for finite k, these no longer square to one, so I have to say they have to be associated with a particular sense of how I interchange the particles. So this really only works in two space dimensions. And these phases correspond to a so-called R matrix, which characterizes this partly characterizes weighting of these particles for SU2 level k theory. Now, how about the encoding? Well, one can use, there are several different encodings we can use, and actually, for this talk, I think in the past, people who have seen me talk about this before, I've used a three quasi-particle encoding, which is really, you just get from this one by removing one particle and taking it to infinity. But it turns out, as you'll see, we can get actually some rather nice. I mean, there's some nice simplifications if we actually use this four quasi-particle encoding. Again, our zero state will be here, this state here, where these two particles have topological charge zero, and the one state will be the state where these two particles have topological charge one. Again, here are the Bertelli diagrams. So here is this. Encoded Hilbert space, so we're throwing away far less Hilbert space than the exchange-based people are. We only want to work in this Hilbert space here for k equals 3. So then the question is now, can I reproduce the calculation? Can I find a braid that actually, first of all, will carry out arbitrary single qubit rotations, and then entangle these two qubits here without leading to leakage error, without leading to states which correspond to paths marked in red here. It turns out it's convenient. I want to focus on the case k equals 3 first because it's special, but then I'm going to talk about more general k. For k equals 3, there's this nice simplification which actually probably many people here know about. If we just focus on the case of particles with topological charge 1, the fusion rules are particularly simple. In fact, according to Paul, they're the simplest possible fusion rules. All the fusion rules are trivial except for this one here. One, fuse one with one, I get 0, 1. If these were ordinary spins, I get a 2, but at level 3, you don't get that 2. And another nice fact is that the remaining fusion rules, for example, the fusion rules for the 3/2 particle. You can see, first of all, they're all trivial in the sense that there's no branching, which means that the particle with topological charge 3/2 is effectively abelian. And I can view a particle with topological charge 1/2 as if it were a particle with topological charge 1 fused to this one of these abelian 3/2 particles. What that means is, at least for purposes of braiding, for purposes of quantum computation, I don't care about overall phases. Because there will be some phases, abelian phases associated with this 3/2 particle. But all the non-abelian content of the braiding properties of the 1/2 particle and 1/2 particles and the 1 particles are equivalent. So for purposes of quantum computation, we might as well, as long as we're sticking with the k equals 3 theory, just consider all the particles as being as having this topological charge 1. And so that's Fibonacci anyway. Okay. So, you want to start braining. And here's one of these encoded qubits, and here are the elementary braid matrices that correspond to interchanging neighboring particles in this qubit. Here, if I interchange these two particles here, I just get these are the appropriate R matrix phases. If I interchange these two particles in the middle here, I have to use this F matrix. I didn't tell you what this F is, but who am I kidding? Everyone here knows what it is. It's this F matrix just changes. In this case, it will just change to a basis where these two particles here are in a topological charge eigenstate, and then we can, in that state, we can we just get the appropriate R matrix phase, and then we transform back with F. So for Fibonacci anions, this is this matrix here. And also, there's a nice feature here is that if I interchange the top two particles, because as long as the total topological charge of these four quasiparticles is zero. If I interchange the top two particles, I get the same phase as interchanging the bottom two particles. So in fact, braiding the top two particles is equivalent to braiding the bottom two. So in fact, I only have to braid three particles to do. There's nothing to be gained by braiding these top two particles here. So all I have to do is just focus on these two elementary braid operations. And then it's very simple to just simply calculate the effect of performing some kind of braid operation here, for example, by dividing into these elementary braid operations and multiplying the appropriate matrices or their inverses, and you get the final state of the system. The final state of the qubit, in this case. So, something else, general rule, which I haven't mentioned, but I think is very plausible, is that as long as you braid inside one of these ovals, it does not change the total, here I call it Q-spin, or topological charge of the enclosed particles. So what that means is if we start in the state zero and keep braiding, we'll stay in the state zero and there's no leakage. So then we can ask, can we do arbitrary single qubit rotations? All right, so again, I can represent these operations as rotations in the qubit space, which I can parameterize with this rotation vector alpha. And so here, and it turns out it's convenient to consider weaving operations. So here I'll take this particle here, the blue particle, and weave it around the bottom particle and bring it back to the position that it came from. So that actually corresponds to sigma 1 squared, or I'll braid this particle around the middle part, up around the middle part of the or part, second particle from the top, and then back down, that's sigma 2 to the minus 2 in this case, or sigma 2 squared, sigma 1 to the minus 2. And these are the rotation vectors that correspond to the qubit rotations that these braids carry out. All right. I can remove the arrows, and then we can ask, well, can we perform arbitrary single qubit rotations? And that really is, the question is just, does this form a, as I start multiplying these matrices together, does it generate a finite representation of the rotation group, or is it dense in SU2? And let's see here, of course, at least for k equals 3, it's dense, and so, and what's happening here is, of course, the number of braids is growing exponentially, so we exponentially fill up this sphere. And so if you give me any particular single qubit rotation you want me to carry out, that corresponds to some point of the sphere, and I can get, I can get as close as I need to get to it as long as I can keep searching for longer and longer braids.
And it approaches the desired one exponentially quickly?
Exponentially quickly, yes. Yes. Right, yes. Yeah. Essentially, they're filling the sphere more or less randomly. So if we could do this brute force search, to arbitrary length, we would be able to, if you gave me a tolerance epsilon, the length of the braid to get within that tolerance would scale as long as column. And so here's the result of a really simple brute force search, nothing particularly clever here, where we just searched all braids up to a certain length. And tried to approximate this operation here, essentially the NOT gate, And this is a, this involves about 24 of those square generators, so 48 brain operations overall. And by doing this, we can get an operation which corresponds to about 10 to the minus 3 of this desired target gate. And then, now there are cleverer brute force methods where we could actually probably improve this further by, for example, doing some kind of bidirectional search. But just as proof of principle, let me just show you this result. It's just a straightforward brute force search. But presumably, I think better brute force search methods might be able to get this number down to 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 5, but not further than that. At some point, the fact that the number of braids is growing exponentially, although that's a good thing because it allows you to approximate single qubit gates to high accuracy, it also makes doing this brute force search infeasible. But there is fortunately, this clever algorithm to Solovay and Tayeb, which allows you to systematically improve an approximate operation like this without doing deeper brute force searches. As long as I have a library of braids that are sufficiently dense in SU2 in this case, then just by cleverly choosing these braids and sawing them together in the right way, I can systematically improve the approximation. And so, for example, here is one iteration of this sort of the simplest version of the Solovay-Tayeb construction. In this case, it improves the accuracy of the braid by about an order of magnitude. And the braid grows by a factor of 5 for each iteration. Again, for this particular implementation, the braid length, if epsilon is this error of the tolerance here, the braid length grows as polylogarithm, so log epsilon to the power of approximately 4. Again, if we could do a straightforward brute force search, this would be log epsilon. But the price we pay for using the Solovay-Tayeb construction is we get some power here. But that's okay. It's just a polylogarithmic prefactor, which isn't a problem for quantum computing. So the point I want to make here is that we can, as long as we're braiding, as long as we're looking for single qubit rotations, as long as we're looking for something in SU2, we can really very efficiently find braids which approximate whatever you want. Now, if we were actually considering, say, SU3, you can do that as well, but it would not be anywhere near as efficient because there's a prefactor here which will grow as which is proportional to the dimensionality of the search space. So here for SU2, the search space is three-dimensional. We just have to fill up the sphere. For SU3, it's already eight-dimensional, and is going to make it, if you try and just directly do Solovay-Tayeb in SU3, you're not going to get anywhere near as efficient an approximation to whatever you want as you can get in SU2. So that's an important point because at the end of the day, what I want to show you is we can reduce everything we have to do to doing Solovay-Tayeb in SU2, and I argue that's a good thing to do. Even if you could do it in SU3 or some higher group, it's always going to pay from the point of view of just efficiency. This is the most efficient braid for a fixed amount of classical computer time to break everything into problems that are equivalent to what I've just shown you here, finding braids that approximate some operation in SU2. Okay, so that that solves the problem of single qubit rotations, and that's the solution for single qubit rotations that's given by Friedman, Lawson, and Wang. So we haven't done anything new here, just simply implemented it. What about two-qubit gates? So here I have two of these four quasi-particle qubits. And as we braid them, you can see there are a couple of complications. The first is we're no longer doing all of our braiding exclusively within a qubit. We're actually pulling particles out of their qubits. And that means this rule that says as long as we braid inside an oval, we don't change the total topological charge, no longer protects us from leakage errors. So the final state typically will these qubits will not have total topological charge zero. They will typically be leakage errors. And perhaps even worse, the braid matrices acting on the Hilbert space of now, these are eight particles with total topological charge zero, is that Hilbert space is 13-dimensional, so we would have to do, if we wanted to just simply directly apply this Solovay-Taylor algorithm here, we would have to apply it in SU13, so the analog of that three-dimensional sphere we were searching before becomes 168-dimensional search space, which means there's simply this, although technically efficient, I mean, one could certainly do this in principle, but in practice it's simply impossible. So just simply, you know, searching the space of braids of these eight particles and looking for some operation, specific operation in this 168-dimensional search space is by just straightforward brute force search is not feasible. So what we'd like to do as I mentioned earlier is just divide everything, break everything into SU2, into smaller SU2 problems that I've shown we can handle efficiently. Okay, so but here let's just keep this again. This is just a generic braid. We might as well imagine calculating the unitary transformation corresponding to this braid. It's going to be some big 13-dimensional matrix, and let's be optimistic and snip out the 4x4 part of that matrix that acts within this logical qubit space. So it maps the logical qubit states it acts on logical qubit states and brings you back to the logical qubit states. So that particular 4x4 block of our 13-dimensional matrix. Of course, because we've snipped this block out of a bigger unitary matrix, this block is in general, is not going to be unitary because there are going to be other non-zero entries here and here. And those entries correspond to leakage error. So in this context, leakage error just corresponds to the fact that this matrix is not unitary. Okay, so we want to somehow, again, simple brute force approach isn't going to work, so we have to be somewhat clever. So the first idea is, well, let's look for a particular class of gates, control gates, where I'll call this blue qubit the control qubit and the green qubit the target qubit. And we're looking for some sort of braid which is going to do something to the target qubit if the control qubit is in state 1 and do nothing if the control qubit is in state 0. And if that's our goal, it naturally suggests the idea of not braiding one particle at a time, but braiding pairs of particles. So for example, if we take this pair here, which is now dark blue, and weave it through the particles in the target qubit, then if so here let me just show doing that, so what happens when we do that. So here we go. There's another important rule which I think is again quite plausible. That we braid out any braiding objects with topological charge zero doesn't induce any transition at all. So if A is equal to zero, this pair has topological charge zero, and we can weave it through the target all day long, and it's not going to change anything. Whereas if it's in the state 1, it will induce some transition. But if it's in the state 0, we're guaranteed, we've at least fixed 12 of the entries in this matrix. We know that this block has to be precisely the identity. And then by unitarity, we know all of these entries have to be 0 as well. So by restricting our braids to this class of braid, we've reduced the problem now to trying to fix this little 2x2 block to be unitary. Again, it's typically not going to be unitary because this final, the final label here of these of the qubits will not typically be zero. Okay. So what can we, so can we make that even easier? And actually, we can. So there's another idea. Let's rather than braiding this pair through through just widely through the target Boston particles, let's braid it around these pairs of the target Boston particles, the pairs which have total topological charge B. So I've restricted the class of grades I'm looking at even further. And that simplifies things, again, because if this label B is zero, again, this braid produces no transition at all, because even if this has topological charge one. So here I've labeled, because the case when this pair has topological charge zero is trivial, let's just focus on the case when it's one. If B is equal to zero, we can weave this through, and all day long, and it's not going to change any. It's not going to lead to any transformation. So that simplifies this matrix even further. We've exactly, if B is equal to zero, we know that again, this entry has to be one, and again, by unitary, these entries have to be zero here. So we've reduced everything to just a single number by considering this class of braids. We have to fix this number. We just have to make sure it has unit magnitude, and if so, then this matrix is unitary and there's no ligature. So the only non-trivial case is when both A and B are equal to one. Right. This construction takes care of every other case. So let's set A and B equal to one. And so now our goal is to somehow find a weaving pattern here which fixes this entry to have unit magnitude. It does not lead to any ligature. But now let me remind you about Fibonacci anions, since we're still focusing on the K plus 3 case. For Fibonacci anions, Fibonacci anions have total topological charge 1. So these pairs of particles for this particular case, the only non-trivial case, these pairs are effectively Fibonacci anions themselves. So this braid is really equivalent to a braid just braiding 4 Fibonacci anions, but now they correspond to these pairs of particles with total topological charge 1. And weaving it through these two target particles. But now you can see we've reduced the problem of finding a 2-qubit gate to finding, this is effectively, we're back to a single qubit rotation. This is just a big qubit in the state 0. All right, so the overall topological charge is 0. That's never going to change as long as we're braiding a single particle. And this pair of particles has, this is a qubit, if you like, in the state 0. And then the final state, you don't know, it depends on the braid. So we've reduced the problem to one I showed you we can solve efficiently, which is a single qubit rotation problem. So all we have to do is find some single qubit rotation where I take this blue particle and weave it through the green particles so that it approximates an operation which corresponds to no ligature, which in this case means I want to make sure that if I start in the state 0, 0, I end in the state 0, 0 here, because this having to transition to the state 1 here, that would correspond to leakage. And this entry, the 0, 0 entry, is just this entry here. So this is, in fact, this matrix element here is precisely that A 4, 4 in the previous matrix that we need to fix. So all we have to do is, this is the result of an actual brute force search, to approximate that to, and again, to this length, it approximates it to about one part in 1,000. So all I have to do is weave this pair through following this braid. If I go back to the full qubit, this is what we have is a controlled phase gate. I take this pair of particles, weave it through the target, but weaving it through in this way where I weave it around pairs of particles in the target, following this this weaving pattern that corresponds to this particular single qubit rotation. And here's that 4x4 block of the 13x13 matrix, and we get all the elements are exactly right, except for this one here, which will not be precise, will not have precisely unit magnitude, except in the limit that the grading becomes infinitely long. There will always be some leakage error, but we can control it and make it as small as we need to make it in order to do quantum computation, the particular computation we might want to do. So I guess this is the thing that should be compared to the movie that John showed.
Do you actually know that controlled phase like that is not in the grade image?
It's
not exactly in the grade image?
I don't know in the with certainty, but now I assume when you say grade image,
to the image of the representation.
And so let me translate to something that something I might understand. You mean there is there just a finite grade like this,
yeah,
that hits exactly? No, I don't believe so. But I don't know how I don't know how to prove it. But again, you know, you'd have to exactly find some weaving pattern where you weave this particle through and it comes back to this position here, and for which there's for which these entries are precisely zero. Just well, I have to base it on experience of just multiplying these matrices, but maybe there's I'm sure there there must be a cleverer proof. Maybe this some sort of Galois theory proof that I wouldn't understand, but I'm happy to believe.
Well, Nick,
yeah.
How many grades you have here, just
quickly? Well, okay, this weaving pattern, well, it depends how you count braids. I can always count, if I count braids here, I get one thing. If I count braids here, they're actually, you know, have to weave two particles past two particles. Do you count that as one weave, one braid, or
four?
Okay, then it's four times this, and this is about, they're about 46, so four times 46. So in fact, if you compare this, this is a new construction, and this, by the way, I really wanted to give credit to my graduate student, Leila Hormozi, who came into my office one day and said, oh, we can do this, and I was a little shocked to realize, we were so stuck on the three quasi-particle qubit encoding, we missed this, I think, really, this is probably the simplest construction. It only works if you use these four quasi-particle qubits. So again, because it's because we've reduced everything to this single qubit operation level, this SU2 level, we can run this Solovay-Gitaev algorithm, and here's the result of one iteration of this, and this approximates this controlled phase gate to 1 part in 10 to the minus 5. Now I think one can do better than this with better brute force search. We haven't focused on that aspect of this problem. We're just looking for, we're focusing on this idea of reducing everything to doing Gitaev Solovay in SU2. That's our sort of fundamental principle, which we believe will lead to the most efficient rates for this particular kind of quantum computation. Okay. So that's all for k equals 3. Oh, right, and so I can summarize, but so if you like, this is a, these braids are a kind of Q-deformed version of these exchange-based quantum computing sequences. So, right, so this is for k equals 3, for Fibonacci EVMs. So what about k greater than 3? Can we use the same construction? Well, first of all, I mean, you know, everything goes through the same. In fact, this is, it's all, discussed in Friedman-Larsson and Wang. The quasi-particles have this, we can use the same encoded quasi-particles. And we can do single qubit rotations by grading. So there's the question of density. Are the grade generators dense in SU2? And as is probably well known to people here, well, certainly for k equals 2, that corresponds to the Fockian. They aren't. This corresponds to just one of these sort of weaving operations, and these are 90 degree rotations at right angles to each other, so they're not going to generate a fine, a dense covering of SU2. And likewise for k equals 4, it's also it also stops at some point. I guess this generates the tetrahedral group. But for k equals 3, well, that's the Fibonacci case, and k equals 5 also. And k equals 6, 7, oddly enough, for some reason, k equals 8 is not dense for grading 3 particles like this. But nonetheless, it's still universal for quantum computing. But k equals 9 and higher are all dense. They have all these spheres fill up exponentially fast. So we can certainly you give me any single qubit rotation, say for k equals 5, and we can use the same Solovay-Gitaev technology to produce a grid. believe that approximates it to whatever accuracy you want. So that part goes to the same, but what about the 2-qubit gates? So does this construction work for k greater than 4? So again, now these particles, so since I'm going to, again, general k, these particles are now topological charge 1/2 particles. I mean, since we're no longer the Fibonacci, dealing with the Fibonacci, the k equals 2 theory, we no longer have this equivalence between 1/2 and 1. So now these particles are all topological charge 1/2 particles. But still, it's easy to see everything we did for k equals 3 goes through the same to this point here. If we decide to weave a pair of particles from the control qubit through these pairs in the target, then if A is equal to 0, it does nothing. And if B is equal to 0, regardless of what A is, it does nothing. The only non-trivial case is when A is equal to 1 and B is equal to 1. So again, we're guaranteed to get this 4x4 block. Now it turns out it's a 14-dimensional matrix for all k greater than 3. It's an extra state. But our block here is this 4x4 block acting in a logical qubit space. It still has this form here with only one entry that's not what we want it to be. Okay, so we can play the same game and just view this as grading these pairs. But these pairs are now, we just view them as particles. But now they're particles with topological charge 1. And since we're no longer dealing with the Fibonacci case, one is different than 1/2, so this is no longer the same as a single qubit rotation. And we can see that, in particular, if we look at we're going to start at the state 0, 0 here, so this pair has topological charge 0, and this pair has topological charge 0. We're going to end up in some state where this label C, and whatever this label is, this label has to be the same if the total topological charge is 0. And this label C, it can be 0, 1, or now there's a new feature because for k greater than 3, the topological charge 2 is no longer truncated. So there's a possibility to end in the state where C is equal to 2. So we're no longer dealing with SU2. We're dealing with SU3. The matrices that correspond to these grade operations are three-dimensional. In principle, that's not a problem. One can certainly do a solo Bekhetev in SU3. It's feasible. One could probably get reasonable gates. But again, I don't think you would get the most efficient gate possible because as I've tried to convince you, if you can reduce everything to searching in SU2, you can really get nice grades. And so even though you might pay a cost by dividing pay a cost by a factor of 3 or something by breaking the problem into smaller problems in SU2, I think it will. If that's the way to get the most efficient grade possible for a fixed amount of classical computing power. So can we do that here? And the answer is yes. So this at least shows one can't do a simple one-shot controlled gate using this particular. Kind of great. So let's abandon this and see if we can find something that where everything is happening in SU2. I want to point out this extra feature sort of reflects this the difference in the Hilbert space for k equals 3 and k equals 5. For k equals 3, the leakage problem is actually not that bad because the truncation is helping you. You see, if I'm doing some gate on these 2 qubits. The space I can leak into is only corresponds to these paths shown here. They're cut off. But as soon as I go to k equals 4 or 5 higher, I get this extra state here. That's the 14 that makes the state, the matrix 14 dimensional. And that's what's showing up here. That makes the problem slightly harder. K equals 3 is special for this kind of encoding quantum computer. Okay, but we can deal with this. So the first idea might be to weave this pair of particles rather than through rather than around the pairs of particles in the target, just through the top two particles in some arbitrary way that come back, bring them back. So again, the basic idea, we're not going to give up on this idea of doing a controlled gate by using this construction, because you know, if A is equal to 0, we automatically do nothing, but if A is equal to 1, we can do something. So again, if A is equal to 0, nothing happens. So A equals 1 is the only relevant case, so let's go ahead and set A equal to 1. And then let's look at what's happening at the particles we're braiding. We're braiding this blob, which has topological charge 1, around two particles with topological charge 1/2. I'm weaving and so let's focus on these, treating this as a single particle, if you like, these three objects. This pair starts with topological charge B, and the total topological charge here of D, but of course that's, I mean, in fact, this state is going to be some superposition of different values of this D though. Now, let's see, something else I should point out is, no matter what happens, we know that if I weave through just these top two particles, B is going to be unchanged. These two particles are going to stay in state B. These two particles will stay in state 1. So in order for there to be no leakage error, this pair of particles has to end up in the state with topological charge. Okay. So, what does the braiding look? What do the braid matrices look like in this basis? So, D is the total topological charge. There are three sectors. D can be equal to 0. That corresponds to this entry here. If D is equal to 0, B has to be 1 by the fusion rules. Or D can be 1. If D is 1, B can be either 0 or 1. So we actually get a 2x2 block here. But if D is equal to 2, the only way for D to be 2 is if B is equal to 1. So we're going to get a 1, just a single entry here. So the braid matrices that correspond to the matrix that corresponds to this braid has this form. So we have reduced everything, sort of the non-trivial part is this 2x2 part here. So what do we have to do? Well, one thing we have to do is make sure that all of the elements that correspond to the case when B is equal to 1 are the same. That's because, if I go back here, if B is equal to 1, I'm starting in the state where this qubit is in the state 1, and this qubit is in the state 1. I know I have to end in the state where this qubit is in the state 1, and this qubit is in the state 1. So I start in a single state, I end in a single state, and so if I break this, if I imagine expanding the state in the basis where this label, in terms of eigenstates of this, the total topological charge of these four particles, this D, you know, each of those states in that expansion has to get the same phase back in order to come back to the same state. So these entries all have to be the same. And now there's some work that one has to do, some work to make sure this entry is the same as this entry. But it turns out there's a nice fact, useful fact, that if we consider braids with zero winding, where winding counts the number of total number of interchanges, I don't think this is a braid with zero winding actually, but imagine it is. Then the determinant of each of these blocks has to be 1. By considering zero winding, we fix these entries, these two entries to be 1. And so all we have to worry about is this entry here. We want to make this 1. And so in other words, we have to find some weaving pattern that produces the identity. But if we do that, well, the easiest way to do that is just take this particle straight from here to here. Any matrix we produce other than this matrix will lead to leakage error. So this is a little result that no matter how hard we try, just braids like this will not actually entangle these two qubits. Any braid like this for which there's no leakage error will lead to a non-entangling gate. It will just be equivalent to, well, it will actually, in this case, will correspond to just the identity. And in fact, we can prove more generally that if we braid just these four particles here, any gate we produce that doesn't have leakage error will be non-entangled. Okay, so what do we do now? Well, what we can do is look for a weaving pattern that approximates the same matrix, but let's rather than insisting that we come back to the same position, let's imagine, let's allow for this pair to actually end up on the other side of these two particles. And that we can certainly do, and this is in fact the result of a brute force search, essentially approximating this matrix, the identity, in this basis, to 1 part in 10 to the 3, so again, typical number we get for a brute force search. And what good is that? Well, because when b is equal to 1, when b is equal to 1, this because we have the identity here, it means we'll get one here, and we start and end in the same state, but we've interchanged the pairs of particles, and we've done it in such a way that the phase we get is independent of d. So, which is not easy to do. You could imagine if all I wanted to do is swap this particle with this pair here, I would just take this pair and move it around. But if I do that simply by a single rate like this, I get different phases depending on d. So one has to pay this solar latency price, or the brute force search in this case, and find a rate which approximates the identity. It's kind of perverse, while at the same time permuting the particles, moving this pair of particles down here. So if we do that, well, first of all, if b is equal to 0, if the state of the target qubit is 0, the state, if I weave this through, in that case, I don't even really care about the form of this braid. No matter what happens, the total topological charge of these four particles here has to be 1, because these two particles have topological charge 0, and this pair has topological charge 1. Whereas if b equals 1, what I just tried to convince you is all we do is swap this, we do nothing to the state, we just swap this pair and this with this pair. So now this blue pair is the top two quasi particles in the target qubit. And so in that case, this state, we end up with this state, which has total topological charge 0. So again, I'll go back. If b is equal to 0, the topological charge of this state here is 1. If b is equal to 1, the topological charge is 0. In general, for arbitrary b, we just end up with some intermediate state, which, if b is well defined, the state is well defined. This pair is, of course, in the state with topological charge b, and the overall topological charge is 1 minus b. So b is 1, it's 0, b is 0, it's 1. So we can exploit that fact. So let's take this intermediate state. We produce this intermediate state by this first sort of injection sequence. And now we do another brute force search in SU2, which we can do efficiently. And we try to approximate. So again, this is the same braid. We're braiding of this blob with topological charge 1 around two particles with topological charge 1/2. So the braid matrix has the same form. But now we work hard to find some weaving pattern which has zero winding. So we fix these entries to be 1. And then, but in the SU2 or the SU2 block here, we try to get minus the identity. And if we do that, you can see. If b is equal to 1, the overall label is 0. That corresponds to this matrix element. Whereas if b is equal to 0, the overall label is the overall label is 1, and that corresponds to this element here, matrix element here. So essentially, I give a b-dependent phase to the target qubit. B equals 1, we do nothing. If b equals 0, we give it a phase of pi. And then, but we're still in the same intermediate state. We've just given it this b-dependent phase, and so then we just have to run the inverse of this injection. To extract this pair and return it back into the target. And so the net result of this is again a nice approximate to 1 part in 1,000 approximately 2 qubit gate. Where we've given, again, it's a controlled phase gate where we've given this pi phase factor to the state where b is equal to 0. So if we put it all together, this is the, you get this controlled phase gate. Again, if, So here's the target, here's the control qubit and the target qubit. The control qubit is in state zero. We move this particle through, it does nothing. The control qubit is in state one. We essentially inject this pair into the target, and then we perform this phase operation, which gives you this minus one here, and then we extract it. And although I don't have a proof, I think this is the most efficient way to construct two qubit gates for k equals five and higher. For k equals three is special. You can do it in one shot, but for all other k values, one has to rig it, use this divide and conquer approach. So here's a universal set of gates for k equals five, and I guess that's my last slide. So.